And I work down at Buckhead Church, and my wife and I are foster parents, and I'm excited just to share a few thoughts with you this morning. I was thinking about that first moment where we said yes to being foster parents. Do you remember that moment where you had the thing that clicked where you're like, okay, we're going to do this thing? You remember that? I see two of you nodding. The rest of you are too tired to remember. Okay, so here was our moment as we were in church, and somebody was talking about the need to care for foster kids in particular. The church we were part of at that time in Colorado, they were talking about the need for emergency foster kids. And so it was Sunday. We said, okay, we'll help. We were 26 years old. We were pregnant with our first kid. And then on Monday, we got a phone call. And they said, hey, I know you haven't finished your training yet. We're like, we haven't started our training yet. They said, that's no problem. We've got somebody that we need. Her name's Kayla. She's 15 years old. If you don't say yes, she's going to be homeless. So we're naive. We're like, sure, we'll take her. Where do we pick her up? They gave us the address for the county jail. So we got in our CRV, we drove to jail, and we'd never been to jail before, and we went and, you know, she took off her jumpsuit and put her clothes in a trash bag and threw them in the car. And when we're driving back, we're 24 hours in, having thought about this foster care thing. And Kayla's in the back seat, and she says, you guys, I love you so much. And she was with us for 7 months. And that was the best day that we had. We learned the new normal for Kayla having, you know, having a parole officer on speed dial. We had this new normal of trying to figure out boundaries with a 15-year-old about where she could smoke and where she can't smoke, about figuring out curfew and what do you do when she breaks curfew, and navigating the relationship with her mom. And let me tell you, it was complicated. We then had a kid, and we had four kids pretty quickly, and 4 months ago, we got another call from the state, and they said, you know, my wife is at the doctor's office, and we get a call, and they say, hey, we've got a four-year-old, would you say yes? So I get our kids in the room, and we get on our knees, and we say, kids, what do you think? Should we say yes again? And our kids are all like, yeah, Dad, we should say yes. So, okay, my wife comes home, I might take the kids to McDonald's to go get a Happy Meal so that when he arrives, he's there, and Harrison shows up, the caseworker was there for about 5 minutes. I get home, caseworker is gone, walk in the door, and it becomes clear very quickly that Harrison doesn't speak or understand any English. Harrison only speaks Spanish. Here's Harrison with our kids. And Harrison was with us for a couple months. Check out my two-year-old looking at Harrison like, bro, why are you wearing my Spider-Man costume? You know, and it's all like, man, Harrison was great, fantastic. He wanted to be a good kid, but let me tell you something. Your life is interrupted when you've got a kid who doesn't understand your language. You're trying to get him to siéntate, por favor, at the dinner table. And, you know, I don't speak Spanish. We're living in Google Translate trying to figure out this new normal. I don't know what your yes situation is. I don't know where you first became a foster parent. I don't know where you're at in the journey. But my guess is that being a foster parent, a respite parent, a mentor family, it means that your life is stretched and your life is interrupted. That's not all bad. But here was the new normal for each fostering situation that we've been part of, is that life is stretched, your schedule is stretched, your sleep is stretched, your marriage is stretched, your relationships are stretched. If you have your own biological children, your relationship with your own kids is stretched, and your life is interrupted. Your schedule is interrupted, your sleep is interrupted, your community is interrupted. Maybe you've experienced extended family kind of raising an eyebrow about why you're doing this, and friends that don't want to hang out with you anymore because you've got another kid living in your house. Your life is interrupted. And around this time of year, around the holiday season, is when we start to wonder, or we wonder maybe to an extra degree, why am I doing this? Why did I say yes? Like the Apostle Paul describes the type of life that should come out of us, that the light, that when we're following the Holy Spirit, when His life is in us, He says, this is the kind of life that it's going to look like. Here are the things that are going to come out of you. He says, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. But if you'd held up this mirror to me when Kayla, our 15-year-old, was smoking in our nursery, you would not have seen goodness and kindness coming out of me. And when we were driving at midnight trying to get her to come back home and try to go find her because she had run away, again, you would not have seen patience coming out of me. And when her mom is trying to convince her to come run away, to come live back home, you would not have seen self-control coming out of me. And when Harrison is up all night for the third night in a row crying, Kay, mommy, where's my mom? Where's my mom? You would not have seen joy coming out of me. And when we were at the courtroom for the third day in a row, trying to figure out what's going to happen with his biological family, you would not have seen patience at the system. When I hold this up as a mirror to me, when I've said yes, not only is my life stretched and interrupted, But it becomes pretty clear, like, this is not a list that's describing me particularly well. And if that's you at all, and if this holiday season or this time of year you've thought about giving up or taking a break or hitting pause, if you're worn out, if you're tired, if you feel like if you could just put the word un or anti in front of this list, then it describes you, then you're not the first and you're not alone. In fact, I've been thinking about part of the Christmas story in a little bit of a different light since becoming a foster parent. You're familiar with the story. Mary finds out that she's pregnant, and she runs and tells her cousin Elizabeth. But the problem is that she's engaged, and she's not married yet. And Luke tells us this wonderful story of Mary and Elizabeth celebrating, but they don't mention, Luke doesn't mention her fiancé Joseph at all. Just kind of tells the story, and then she has a baby. Well, Matthew tells us about when Joseph found out that his fiancé was knocked up and the baby wasn't his. And Matthew doesn't tell us how Joseph found out. Maybe he just noticed. Maybe Mary just started showing. Maybe Mary had that awkward conversation with Joseph about, hey, I'm going to have a baby, and obviously he's not yours. And Joseph, Matthew says, decided in his mind, because he was faithful. He was a faithful man. He was viewed as a good man. He had a great reputation. He decided quietly that he was just going to separate himself from her. Well, one night, an angel comes to Joseph in a dream. And Matthew picks up the text right here in Matthew 1. An angel comes to Joseph and says, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary home as your wife. Stay the course. Go ahead and marry her. Because what is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. Joseph, the rumors are true. What you've heard from Mary is true. She is going to have a baby, and it is not yours. I still want you to proceed. You're about to bring a baby home with you that's not yours. I want you to go through with this marriage anyway. The text continues. It says, she will give birth to a son. Listen, it's going to be her son. It's not yours. She will give birth to a son, and you are to give him the name Jesus. Put it another way. Joseph, Mary's going to have a son. I've already picked out the name for you. You get to do everything else. Joseph wakes up from the dream, and he's got a decision to make. Like, Mary wasn't going to have the baby the next day. He's got months of waiting and wrestling with this decision. And I don't know how aware he was about how his life was going to be interrupted. I don't know how aware he was of even who Jesus was going to become. But here's what I think Joseph is thinking about in that moment. It's because he's choosing to adopt or raise this son that's not his. It means he's not going to get a honeymoon. It means that when he goes home with his family, that they're going to not welcome him into their house. It means that when he goes home for the holidays, he's got to go sleep in a barn. It means for Joseph, who was in this little town running a family business, and when you run a small business in a small town, your whole life is built on reputation. It means that Joseph's reputation is going to be in question. And whether or not he thought about it in that moment, I think he's thinking down the road, well, someday we're going to have our own kids, and they're going to grow up with an older stepbrother. And that makes life more complicated. It means that you get raised eyebrows at church. It means that there's people questioning, like, how did this really happen, Joseph? It means you've got to explain yourself. Again, it means that someday when it comes to divide the family business, you've got to decide how to divide it between your real kids and your adopted kids. His life was about to be interrupted. He's got months wrestling in this decision of, what am I going to do with the kid who isn't mine, but who's in my home? For whatever reason, Joseph decides to say yes to mess. He says yes to what's complicated. He says yes to what's uncertain. He says yes to what, you know, isn't the path that he had imagined himself. You know, he dreamt of the day, just like his dad had done for him, where he would get to teach his sons how to fish. He dreamt of the day when he got to teach his boys how to be a carpenter so he could pass off that family business. And everything in an instant turns from what he had expected to be in a life that he hadn't planned for. He says, yes. And you can say, yeah, well, Jesus was perfect. Well, Jesus might have been perfect. I believe Jesus was perfect, but he still had to be potty trained. Okay? Jesus might have walked on water. I believe he did, but he still had to have somebody wipe his nose. Okay? Jesus has still had all the things that come. Even if there was no sin mess, there's still relational mess. There's still life mess. And Joseph, in that moment, decides to say yes. And I kind of wonder why. What was it that made Joseph say yes to that decision? Later on in the New Testament, James gives us a clue. He says this. He says, religion, let me just pause. Religion, that's that word faithful that Matthew had used to describe Joseph. Religion in his context, every other time this word is used in the New Testament, it connotates the idea of a Pharisee about rules and laws and what can be predicted, what can be controlled, what can be certain. How can you make sure that you stay clean? And James says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless, that is, listen, you have one kind of religion. It's everything that's in your little community of Nazareth. Everything that's in front of you about here's the way we behave, and here's what we do, and here's how we act, and then here's the outcome. James says, you want to know what real religion is? Real religion is moving towards the mess. Real religion is this. It's to care. It's to look after orphans and widows. It's to look after people who can't look after themselves, who can give you nothing in return. It's to give to people who don't give you anything back. To look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. James contrasts these ideas of religion, which is clean, and the idea of caring for other people that's messy. And he says, if you you think about religion this way, that it's ordered and controlled and perfect and sustainable. And James says, no, the secret is actually to do the opposite. But how did James know that? How does James know that real religion is caring for people who can't care for themselves? How does James know that real religion is looking after somebody that somebody else couldn't look after? I have an idea. See, Joseph and Mary did go on to have their own kids. Jesus did grow up as the older stepbrother. And one of his younger stepbrothers is James. James grew up as the younger brother to Jesus. From everything that I can tell and that scholars believe is Jesus had a rocky relationship with that family. Nobody is following him and taking notes during the Sermon on the Mount from his family. When he's doing miracles, his brothers and sisters aren't standing there cheering. His brothers and sisters don't show up until after the resurrection. And I wonder what kind of tension there was in that house about the stepbrother dynamic, about the not really one of us dynamic and them. And I wonder how James watched his family as they got that raised eyebrows, as he watched his dad's business have an impact, as he watched his family not be welcomed home for the holidays. And James says, you know how I know about this? You know how I know that religion that's pure is caring for orphans and widows? I wonder if James would say, I know that because I watched my dad. I watched the way my dad accepted my older brother. I watched him take him to school and pack an extra sack lunch. I watched the way that he taught him how to fish and ride a bike. I watched the way that he accepted him when everybody else raised an eyebrow. I watched him accept him into his home, even though it cost him something. See, I know something about this, James says, because I lived it. Because my dad welcomed him when it didn't seem like he had anything to gain. I wonder if we could rewind and go back to that moment when Joseph wakes up from the dream and an angel has spoken to him and he's wrestling in his mind about whether or not he's going to say yes or he's going to continue to say yes. And months later when that baby is crying and they still haven't been on a honeymoon and he's still, it's all interruption. And he's wondering again, do I continue to say yes? I wonder when he's on that donkey and they're riding to Bethlehem. And he's wrestling with, what is this going to cost me? I wonder if you could put your arm around him and say, Joseph, you have no idea of what hangs in the balance of your decision to say yes. Listen, I know that you know that it's an interruption. I know that you know it's going to cost you something. You just have no idea what hangs in the balance right now. Not just about Jesus. Like, not only is this adopted son of yours going to become your king and the savior of the world, but put that to the side for a second, because if you're like me, when you're wrestling with whether to say yes or not, it has very little to do with the foster kid. Like, they're great. And I know that most of them are moving, as our caseworker has told us, they're moving from an F-minus home into at least like a C-plus coming into our house. I'm not worried about the impact on them. Their impact is probably going to be pretty good. They're going to have food and they're going to have clothes. We're going to take them to school. They're going to have a bed to sleep in. That's going to be like what we're told is it's going to be an improvement. I'm worried about the impact on my own family because I've seen the way that it stretches my marriage. It stretches my time with my kids. It stretches my meal time. It stretches my community and my relationship. And I've seen the way that it impacts me. Joseph, pause for a minute about the impact that this is going to have for Jesus, for him to grow up with a dad. Let me tell you about the impact that it's going to have for your son, your biological son. Because someday, Joseph, James, your son is going to become the leader, not just of your family business. He's going to become the leader of the church. Not the church in Nazareth. Not the church in your little small town. James is going to become the leader of the church in the big city. He's going to become the leader of the church in Jerusalem. Joseph, you know how every Sabbath they open the rabbis open up the Torah and they read from the books of Moses? And you know how there's thousands, maybe millions of people who read the Torah every week? Joseph, you can't believe this. But there's going to be a day where your biological son writes a letter that billions of people are going to read. And he watched you. And when he goes to describe what real religion is like, he's going to remember the picture of his dad embracing his stepson, and he's going to say, no, real religion is this. It's saying yes. It's taking care of orphans and widows. Let me just pause and say, if right now you're in the middle of it, stay in it. If right now you're thinking about jumping ship, would you stay the course? If you're wondering whether or not you should get back in the race, talk about it, pray about it, dive in, welcome another person back in your home. I know that it's work. I know that it's interruption, and I know that it's stretching. 15 years ago, my best friend and his wife decided to say yes to foster care. And over the last 15 years, they've gotten a lot of phone calls from the state. And they've said no plenty of times. And they've taken a turn being a mentor a lot and a respite family a lot. But over the last 15 years, they've said yes to fostering 30 times. And here's their picture. Here's them with some of their children on a trip somewhere. It looks like they're at a beach. And this is my best friend. And last month, well, let me pause. Over the years of living in the same community as them, we watched every one of their kids wrestle with this decision. We watched every one of their kids ask, as my kids have asked, when can we return them? We watched all their kids wrestle with time being shared with mom and dad. And we watched their merits have to go to marriage counseling. And we watched them have to upgrade from a CRV to a Honda Pilot to an Odyssey to a 12-passenger van. We watched them wrestle with all the things you never expected that your life, while all of your friends are comparing their trips to 30A, that you would be comparing 12-passenger vans. That's something I didn't expect would happen in my life. And we watched them wrestle with the interruption and wrestle with the mess. And last month, my wife and I got to go to his oldest daughter's, his biological daughter's, wedding. That's this girl right here. And I watched my best friend walk her down the aisle, and standing up for her in front of that church were four of her foster sisters. See, we don't know what hangs in the balance. We're there at the reception and hanging out, and nine of their foster kids are there dancing and hanging out, and they're friends with their kids. And every one of their kids would say, there was a season that I hated it, and I'm so much better for it. We just don't know what hangs in the balance. For you, for your marriage, for your kids, for that foster kid, for you to say yes, to do another lap, to do what my friend Michael and his wife Teresa have done, to run at such a pace that 15 years from now you're still in the race, to keep saying yes to the degree that your family is healthy and your heart is tender, to keep saying yes to the degree that you're dependent on the Holy Spirit and you're still in it. Here's what's remarkable about you, about the 120 kids who are part of the Fostering Together program right now, is that 97% of the kids who come through this ministry, it's their last stop. For 97% of the kids who are in your homes, it's the last stop they have before they get to a permanent placement. That's remarkable. 5 years ago, I took a group of 20 or so teenage boys who were all in foster care, and we took them to a college trip. And we went on a tour, and we talked about what college is, and we gave them a backpack, and we had this whole weekend experience. 2% of foster kids graduate from college. So we just want to buck that trend. We want to do something about that. So we took them. Well, that evening, we're sitting around the fire pit, and we're just sharing stories with these guys, and they're going around the circle telling about how a 14-year-old has been in 14 different homes for Christmas, about how a 17-year-old has been in 20 different homes, about how a 15-year-old is on his 12th home. And here's what you're doing. You're changing the narrative. You're saying 97% of the kids that are in your home, it's going to be their last stop. And maybe you're saying what my wife and I have started saying to each other is this. It's all say yes to disruption so that they don't have to. I'll say yes to my home and my mealtime and my finances and the car that I wanted to drive and the community that maybe I wanted to be part of and what I wanted to do on Saturday morning. Yeah, I'll say yes to that disruption so that they don't have to. James says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. He's just contrasting this idea of what is certain and what is messy, what is controlled and what is unpredictable. He says, it's to look after orphans and widows and their distress. He says, I can promise it's going to be messy. I can promise it's going to be confusing. Bringing two families together anytime is confusing and complicated. It's like he's saying this, we're going to say yes to mess and their distress. Yep, it's going to cost you something. Yep. It's going to be uncertain. Yes, it might be a little bit messier. And maybe that was part of God's plan. It's because he wants to draw us away from religion that is about rules and about getting it right and about being certain and move us towards a position of trust. Because for me, yes, having Harrison in my home increased the level of mess and it also increased my level of dependence. It decreased my amount of comfort and it increased my level of trust. I thought about it this way, that every time I increase my dependence, it increases my dependence. Increasing my dependence, the number of little lives in my home, increases my dependence. Read through the book of James and watch how James says, listen, my goal for you is that your faith would move from your head and your heart into your feet. That you would take steps and you would have a faith that is moving, that is vibrant, that is active, because that's the kind of faith that's dependent. James says, when you move outside of yourself, you're going to discover more than yourself. When you move out of what you can control and what you can predict and what you can do, you're going to discover a dependent trust that's better than what could be controlled. That's better than what could be certain. And I don't know how Joseph did it, and I don't know what he wrestled with. But I know that we don't have to do it alone. God promises that he's going to come and meet us. And he's going to partner with us. He's going to come alongside us. In fact, here's what he says that list is going to look like. When we're in step with the Spirit, he says, here's the kinds of things that I can promise you. It's love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. In fact, I think that we can think about this as a roadmap of where you can ask God specifically for help. Where you can say, if you're like me and you're driving home and you know it's about to be noisy when you pull into that garage, you know it's about to be chaotic and you say, God, I don't have any peace left inside of me. Would you help me? I don't have any peace left, but because of you, I can do it. It's when you get woken up at 4:30 in the morning again. And you look in the bathroom mirror and you said, I don't have any love left. All I have is tired left. But Holy Spirit, because of you, would you specifically help me be able to be loving today when I can't on my own? In a few minutes, the band's going to come back. And they're going to play a little bit of music. And what I'm going to encourage you to do is think about what's the one or two for your family that you can invite God's Spirit to help you with so that you can stay in it. That where you maybe don't have anything left in the tank, but because of God's Spirit, you can. And we have little clings that you can use as reminders for you to help you to say, I'm going to take this one that says peace, and I'm going to put it on my garage door opener. So that when I'm pulling into the garage, I can just look up there and say, God, I can't do it again, but because of you, I can. I'm going to put this one, kindness, on my kids' file Because every time I have to encounter the state and the system, I am out of kindness. I don't have any more words left about how to be kind, but God, because of you, I can. Maybe for you, it's self-control. And every time that you get in the car and they're buckled in back there and they know that you're strapped in and you can't do anything about it and you run out of self-control while you're driving and you just put that little self-control sticker on your rearview mirror and say, God, I can't anymore, but because of you, I can. Maybe it's goodness. Because when you're preparing dinner and then you're cleaning up after dinner, it doesn't feel good anymore. And you don't feel like there's going to be goodness coming out of you, but God, I can't anymore, but because of you, I can. Maybe it's joy. That you're like me and you feel like the joy reserves are running out and all I really have left is grumpy. But God, I don't know that I can be joyful anymore, but because of you, I can. Paul gives us this list of where we can invite God specifically to help us. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a few minutes where this list is going to stay up here, and I would love for you to pause and to pray and to ask God, what's the one or two, maybe three, that for us as a family can be our new battle cry, that can be our new calling card, that can be the thing where we specifically invite God to come in so that we can stay in it? Because listen, like you know, saying yes to foster care is one of the best decisions I've ever made and one of the hardest. And we have no idea what hangs in the balance, and you have no idea who's watching. Not just of the kids that are staying in your home, but the family who's raising an eyebrow, the neighbors who don't understand, the teachers that you're having to navigate different last names with, about your own kids who are watching mom and dad open their home. After Jesus was resurrected, we went back to heaven, and Joseph is probably dead. James stands up in a room full of religious people. And he says something that Andy talks about a lot. James is thinking about religion and should we include the Gentiles? Should we include people who are not in our family? And James says, listen, I just think we shouldn't make it difficult for people who are coming to God. I think we should open the doors and welcome in people who weren't initially part of this family. James, why? I don't know. I just watched my dad do it. I just watched my dad say yes when it seems like he shouldn't. And we can do it. And we can have help. The band's going to come and they're going to play a little bit and just take the time that you need to invite the Lord to say, where do we need the most help? And where can you partner with us so that we can stay in it? And I'm going to come back up and I'm going to lead us through communion. And when you come forward for communion, and I'll give you instructions about that in a minute, you can come and take one or two of these little clings for your reminder for you and for your family. But right now, let's just pause and ask God, where do you want to help us? Where can I ask for your help so that I can stay in it?
just become more aware of your presence. Let us experience the glory of your goodness. Let us become more aware of your presence. Let us experience.